This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Welcome to the Escape Hour. This is Fiona. Now, we are missing the lovely Russ today. He had a family emergency and he needed to attend to. But instead, Russ, you are missing out because we've got a whole party in the studio. Dylan is filling in. Hello, Dylan. Thank you so much.
Good afternoon.
Dylan has been here doing amazing breakfast shows and now he's sticking around for the Escape Hour.
I'm very excited.
And we also have a fabulous guest in Rita Ehrlich. How are you, Rita?
Welcome. I'm extremely well.
That's good to hear.
I'm not escaping.
You're not escaping. Also in the studio, we have Stefan, who is sitting in from the radio training program at Joy. Welcome, Stefan.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
And Tess. Tess, our newsreader, is sitting in, and today we are talking all about food. Tess, you want to say a quick hello?
Oh, hi. My favourite subject ever, so really excited.
Excellent. So we're all going to talk about food and we're all going to talk about ask questions of Rita. Now, I probably should give Rita a really formal introduction. So Rita Ehrlich has spent nearly a lifetime of writing and talking about food, from recipes to restaurant reviews, small and large producers. She talks about nutrition, horticulture. Very importantly, she talks about wine. And today we're going to discuss the food industry. We're going to be really practical. And then towards the end of the show, we're going to talk, we're going to talk about Rita's favourite travel destinations. And I think we've got some surprising segues coming up. Rita, thank you for coming on the show.
It's a pleasure.
Now, I hear that you've gained some good brownie points for being on Joy today.
I have. I've got real brownie points from one of my sons and his partner. Joy's their kind of their radio station. And when I said, I'm on Joy at lunchtime, they said, Joy, why didn't you say? Hi there.
Hi, thank you for tuning in and welcome to Joy. So, Rita, today I guess one of the things that we're going to be talking about is the food and beverage industry, not just hospitality, not just restaurants, but you will be talking at an event coming up called Helping Make Food Dreams a Reality, the Business of Food Expo that's coming up at the Kingston City Hall.
March the 5th.
Excellent. One of the reasons why we thought it was so important to talk about is because the hospitality industry most directly affects a lot of people that we know. Not only do we eat in it, not only do we drink, not only do we participate, but many people we know and many of us work in the industry. And it has a massive effect, of course, on our life in Melbourne. But also because what's been fantastic over the last few years has been this revolution in people really wanting to know more about where their food comes from.
Yep.
And that's been one of the most fantastic things. I work with a lot of chefs and often they tell me about the questions that they're getting within their restaurants, people asking them, where is my beef from? Where is my yogurt from? I mean, that's a question. Where are my eggs from? I think that's a really important one.
Eggs is a crucial one because there are some shocking conditions for hens, and there are some fabulous conditions for hens.
That's
right. I visited a place recently, and the hens, I mean, I thought, I'd like to come back as one of these hens. They had huge areas to roam around. They were protected by maremmas. Every 10 days, they moved to a new paddock, so they had fresh grass. And chook poo is not good for soil long term. So that moving them around from week to week meant the soil stayed healthy.
Wow, I was not aware of that, although I am obsessed with free range. I don't even buy the free range at the supermarket. I go out of my way to the health food shop and buy the free range there. Now, of course,
nobody really knows what free range means, and that's one of the problems. Mm.
I've actually heard it can be as little as 1 metre square. and that's determined as free range.
That is,
I don't know if that's the absolute truth, but I did hear that.
Well, that's what the egg board is certainly going for.
Well, that's the size of a small backyard, very, very, very a balcony. Yeah, that's the size of a balcony. Yeah, you could put a chook on a balcony, but you need lots of good litter for it and food and...
Yeah, I don't think it's enough.
No, it's not enough.
No, it certainly, I don't think, qualifies as free range, and I guess that's one of the controversies because there's so many different people, you know, I mean, the egg industry, there's certainly plenty of people, big people in the egg industry that are advocating for smaller quantities of space for the chickens. Well, this show's headed off in a really unusual direction. Yes, this is not what we were planning, but I love it.
But this is about this segue is into the food conference, the business of food, because chooks are part of the business of food.
They sure are.
Eggs are part of the business of food because it's not only where your eggs come from, but where the chooks come from. If you like roasting chickens, as I do, there's some pretty weird stuff out there, and there's some gorgeous stuff out there.
Well, you know, I mean, I don't know what the percentage increase of interest in organic chickens and organic meat certainly has risen massively. I think that one of the challenges you have in that space is that a lot of the things that we're speaking of are not necessarily made affordable for people with families. I think that's probably one of the concerns.
And organic on its own may or may not be a good thing. I mean, I know in the wine industry, for instance, people are using chemicals that keep the frogs in the vineyard. So these are really soft, very, very targeted pest controllers, if you like.
That keep the frogs in? Wow.
Yeah. So it's not that you're killing everything in sight every time you use a pesticide.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLB, TIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to the Escape Hour. This is Fiona. We have a full studio today with Dylan panelling and filling in for Russ. We've got Tess, who's not talking news but talking food. We have Stefan, who is our Taste of Radio buddy. And then we have the wonderful Rita. Thanks, Rita, again for coming on the program.
It's a pleasure.
So I think that one of the things that we wanted to talk to you about was some of the challenges that face people in the hospitality industry. So many. You know, we know people have dreams. Sometimes when it comes to, you know, setting up their own restaurants or their bars, which sometimes turn into nightmares.
Yep.
I mean, you've been doing this and writing about this for quite a while.
Yep, I have. And as for following your dream, a niece of mine left a note on the fridge which read, "Follow your dream, but don't forget to take your brain with you."
Very well said. She's smart.
She's very smart.
Very smart.
And I mean, I think that's one of the difficulties. The dream is one thing, but how you make it practical, how you make it real is another. And in the hospitality industry, there are huge, huge challenges. And one of the greatest of them is making a profit.
I know the profit margin on many restaurants is, what, only 3 or 4%?
Yeah, and that's in a good year for many people. And so the margins are very, very low and not helped by the diners who go in and say, "Oh, $30 for a steak? I can buy one at the supermarket for less than that." Well, off you go. Do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Don't forget to factor in the cost of the house, the cost of the kitchen, the cost of the energy, the cost of you going shopping.
Yeah, and you're not counting in the amount of time that it takes to prepare, to buy, and all those sorts of other things. Yeah. I mean, time does equal money. Everyone values their own time pretty preciously, so you should value the time of the people that are preparing the food.
Yeah, that's right. Other challenges, apart from the challenge of making it, depending on what you're doing, the hours are difficult. And physically, it's really demanding. I mean, people doing the simplest thing, which is running a little cafe, and the city's full of them, tiny, tiny spaces where people serve coffee, really good coffee. They're on their feet all day. All day, as you are in a restaurant too. I mean, talk to anyone who waits on tables and get them to wear a pedometer.
We were talking a little bit off air about the recent conversations that have been had in the food and beverage industry around depression and suicide in the business, and it's certainly something that's very that's a really good conversation to be having.
I think it's terribly, terribly important, and I know a number of people in the industry who are doing all sorts of things. I know one, and you do things on big level, on a big level or on a small level. I know one chef who's got a big place in the city, and he said, at the end of service, we all sit down over a beer. And he said, we sit down over a beer and we spend about 40 minutes talking, sometimes longer. So we go through the night, we go through what's gone right, we go through any problems. So nobody goes home stewing.
Wow, that's a great initiative.
Yeah, it's a fabulous initiative.
Well, do you think perhaps, Rita, that some of the, we understand that the rise of some of the famous cooking shows, of course, which people are somewhat obsessed with these days, that there has been benefits to those shows in some ways because they have ushered in an increased interest in what is going on people's plates, what people are eating, where your food is coming from. But there could...
I'm sorry, what are your thoughts? I'm frowning. Because the next time I go through a supermarket... The next time there isn't a whole row of crisps with weird flavours that sound like soap, you know, dried fig and rose water, balsamic and sea salt and all the rest of it. The next time I go through and there are shelves and shelves of soft drinks and snacks, when that happens, then I'm going to say to you, yeah, you're quite right. People really do care about what they eat.
I see. Yes, I get your point there, Rita.
I think lots of people do, but I also think that what's happening on many of the food shows is untranslatable. If you're looking at sort of some bad behaviour. What? She thinks this is good.
That's right.
That's replicated at tables all around Australia. What, you expect me to eat this? I don't like this. But what they're doing isn't practical. It's not the question that everyone dreads. What's for dinner tonight?
Yes, so true. I don't know. I don't think I've ever been very good at cooking the family meal every night.
You get used to it, but you do get a bit snappy about it.
I remember many years ago I had a partner I was really loving asparagus and I had a partner. I guess I might have only been about 22 at the time, and I remember they said, not asparagus again. And I think at that point I said to myself, that's it. I'm never coming home and cooking dinner for somebody ever.
Who says that? That's right. Whereas if he'd been clever, he would have said, asparagus again?
I think a lot of these bunches of things are getting bigger too. And so, you know, you do feel obliged to eat the same thing a few nights in a row because we don't have the neighbours we used to have. You know, you can't share a large bunch of spinach with someone.
Yeah, that's right.
Yep.
But some things get smaller. Punnets of berries get smaller.
Mm. Well, they're also on discount a lot in supermarkets as well.
And rarely are they ripe.
Yeah. Exactly. And then, my housemate comes home with like five bundles of strawberries and I'm like, you don't need five. Because, but they're only $2.
Yeah.
You're going to just throw them out.
Yes, how much do you like strawberries? You're making the strawberry sorbet. Fantastic.
Yeah, I do find actually I go through the fridge at the end of the week and I actually make food out of all the things that are not being eaten by my housemates.
That terrible moment where you pull something out of the fridge and you think, what was that?
That's true. Now, none of us like waste, and certainly we are encouraged to buy lots and lots of food these days. I'm not exactly sure why. What do you think, Rita, perhaps about... You know, we do have these, you know, food programs, whether or not they're beneficial. But outside of that, we have a lot of innovators in the industry, which is what's made Melbourne's food scene so incredible. Not just Melbourne, but in Australia, of course, we have an amazing food scene. And you've seen the growth of that because, you know, back in the 80s, there was also exciting things happening in food, but just not en masse.
That's right. And I remember it's interesting every year at the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival, Legends launch, where you get people who are made legends talking about things. And Jeff Dobson always gets up and says, he's a potato grower. And the Dobsons really introduced varietals into the market. And Jeff, I remember Jeff being really cross with me because I'd written a piece saying, why can't we get more than one variety of potato anywhere? And he said, well, we're growing them, but nobody's talking about them. And he brought in varieties that I'd never heard of. This is, you know, we're going back into the 80s, like Kipfler and Desiree, which was often known as Daisy Ray. Daisy Ray, which is really sweet. So there's been that sort of innovation. There's been the rise in organics. That's been new. There's been a huge rise in prepared foods.
Right, for time-poor people.
Yep, and foods that you phone a restaurant and it's delivered to you. So the last big food show, whose name I've forgotten, the exact name I've forgotten, but it's the food and food service show. The thing that amazed me was how much space was devoted to packaging. Mm. And I'm thinking, why packaging? And then someone said to me,
it's increased.
Uber Eats and all the rest of it, how you send your food, look, and a restaurateur said to me when I mentioned it to her, yeah, that's really, really important to us. How we send our food out matters.
Well, it does, because it's got to be represented at the very end. I mean, I know people that run burger chains, and they have to alter the you can't use the same buns that you use in the restaurant because the buns don't travel that well. They have to cook the patties in a slightly different way, so they have to alter their product so that it arrives as warm as possible
and tasting as good as it can. Because mostly you don't have a plate of food and say, all right, I'll eat that in 15 minutes when it arrives. Mm. Yeah, it's cooked and you eat it.
Look, I'm seriously not a fan either. If you want to eat food, go out and get it yourself.
But you know that packaging's also on the rise in supermarkets, which is, I find that quite disturbing, and it obviously helps shelf life, which is, it's good in one way. I mean, you don't want to buy produce that when you get home it's not fresh, but
well, in supermarkets too, you've got the other problem that if things aren't packaged, you get people picking up avocados, squeezing them like mad to find out if they're ripe. You know, putting enough pressure on to dent them, and then saying, "No, I don't want that one," and putting them back. So the amount of waste you get in many shops is huge because of that, because of people handling food carelessly. And for supermarkets, one of the ways is just to package things up in kilo bags or half kilo bags or minuscule pack punnets for berries.
Which is fine, I think, so long as you don't get it home and then get really disappointed about the quality of the product.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But there are all sorts of things. There are lots and lots of farmers markets. There are very good fruit greengrocers around.
Well, certainly we are blessed in Melbourne because we have three of the most fantastic markets, which is more than what a lot of other cities have. So that is something to be celebrated. And you've got the wonderful potato lady at the South Melbourne market.
Yep.
She has so many kinds of potatoes and different colours. It's incredible.
Yeah, that's right. And there are all sorts of mushrooms. That's the other thing that's happened. Varieties of things. So tomatoes now come in all shapes and sizes and colours. So do potatoes, so do mushrooms.
I was at work.
I was riding my horse.
I was microwaving a watermelon.
My iguanas escaped.
There are lots of reasons why you may have missed your favourite show, but don't worry, because our podcast team has you covered. They'll work through rain, hail and national glitter shortages to bring you the best bits of every show. Visit joy.org.au and click on the podcast tab, or head to the iTunes Australia podcast store and subscribe to your favourite shows for free. Thanks to our podcasters, you'll never feel guilty about missing a show again. Joy.org.au.
we're talking food.
We are talking food. Many, many aspects of it, the diversity of food that makes up our great city, but also that, you know, obviously we need to, we need very much breakfast, lunch and dinner. Dylan, you had a question you wanted to ask Rita.
I'm a bit of a social media fan and I love going out for brunch. How has Instagram and visual social media affected the food industry?
I think it's affected it hugely. It's certainly affected the way chefs plate up their food, because everyone knows that it's going to be photographed and sent off, so it has to look good. And so there are lots of dots and smears and things that photograph really well, sometimes eat well. But there are things, you know, there are things that simply don't photograph well. And if you're eating them and you love them, don't bother about photographing them. Risotto.
Is that the importance of garnishing and
porridge never looks good.
Not good on a wooden board?
Porridge? No. It runs everywhere. Although you could put a ring of bananas round it and make it
very creative.
Or you could use some steel cut oats for your oatmeal instead. They are, you know, pretty robust.
But do they look that? Porridge never looks good. Risotto rarely looks good.
But you use your eyes to want to be able to eat food, isn't it? Is it not like eating artwork?
Well, when was the last time you ate a Leonardo da Vinci?
I don't know.
When was the last time you ate Mona Lisa? Most food isn't artwork. Yeah, most food's designed to look nice so that it doesn't arrive at the table, unless it's porridge, and have people saying, oh, do I eat this?
Do new businesses spend too much time focusing on the visuals?
Look,
making it look good on social media?
It depends very much on the place itself. There are some places where how food looks is really, really important. I mean, it's sort of like dressing people. I mean, sometimes you're fine in jeans and a T-shirt, but you don't want necessarily to be photographed in jeans and a T-shirt and no makeup and be known for that all your life. How food looks matters. So does how food smells matters even more, I reckon.
Mm, definitely. Our plate comes to me. I usually lift the plate to my nose and take a good sniff before I eat it, because I'm very interested in the smell of food.
That's right. And the smell of food makes you hungrier, I think, than the look of food.
Well, that's good, because you can't smell through social media. That could be a good thing. I mean, I know that there was a restaurant in the US, I think, that actually noticed a massive increase over a number of years in the complaints that they would get from their diners. And they also coincidentally had been filming their restaurant over a number of years as well. And they charted the increased use of people on their phones to the increased number of complaints.
Yep, that's right. Pay attention to what you're eating, what you want to say to people.
Yeah, exactly. So people were on their phones so that they weren't always approached by the wait staff when they get there. So then they complained that the service wasn't as good because it took them longer, but they were on their phones. And then when the food arrives, of course, they don't eat it immediately because they're taking photographs of it. And then they're complaining that the food is cold. They're not actually connecting with the food in the same way. Now, I'm not going to say that's for everybody. I certainly am guilty of taking photos of my food.
Yes, so am I. We all are. Guilty as charged. But we also know what we're doing, in that taking the photograph isn't the main point.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's Instagram. It's not set it up and take half an hour getting it perfect. You take one shot and then you're into it. Mm. But I think that and the expectations that people have over, through social media are often quite unrealistic.
I agree with you there, without doubt. And I think that the pressure to create food that is only good for a photograph is massive, and I'm sure that that makes it even a bigger challenge for so many restaurants and so many producers.
Yeah, no, and add to that the number of things that people think they can't eat.
Oh, yes.
That's right. There rise and rise.
I'm being unkind. There are food allergies. Of course there are. And there are anaphylactic reactions. And nobody wants to serve a dish and then phone it for an ambulance.
No, it's not something you want outside your restaurant.
No, it's not something you want in your home either. Mm. But I think the difficulty comes with people who've just read the latest issue of whatever magazine and where it's been suggested that this or that or the other is absolutely the food you should be eating or should be avoiding. And suddenly you get people with bizarre requests and saying bizarre things. I heard two women on a tram talking, and one of them said to the other, "Well, I blame my mother, of course."
Oh,
really?
Doesn't everybody blame their mother?
Yeah. And I pricked up my ears to think, now, what problem was that? And she said, "My mother drank milk all the time she was pregnant with me." And I'm thinking, golly, where do I unpick this one?
Yep, that's exactly right. I used to blame my mother for the fact that I couldn't finish the plate, that I had to always finish the plate of food.
Oh, yes, those were the days.
Because I wasn't allowed to get any ice cream unless I ate the whole plate of food. And so to this day, I have to finish the whole plate of food.
Oh, I was spoiled. I never had to finish.
Wow. Rita. Lucky you.
And the rule is, for kids, I reckon, when the kids say, "Look, I've had enough to eat," you say, "Are you sure?" And if they say, "Yeah, that's fine," and then you say, "Well, you know," when they say, "But I will have the ice cream and I will have the sweets and I will have..." "Sorry, I thought you'd have enough to eat." "Oh, yeah, but there's a second stomach for dessert."
Now, Rita, I know that you'll be speaking at this particular expo, which we'll talk about again towards the end of the show. But today you also mentioned that you will be emceeing at a very special event this evening to someone who is very close to you.
That's right. Philippe Mouchel is hosting a dinner to celebrate the life of Paul Bocuse. And Paul Bocuse, for those who don't know, wasn't just an old French guy. He died when he was 91. But he changed the face of the industry in France.
Wow, that is massive.
It was massive.
I mean, the industry in France, you can't even imagine, is changeable.
Well, he did his best. And he was the first... All the things we talk about now, chef superstar... chef with many restaurants, tick. Chef giving his name to foods and other products, tick. Chef championing local produce, tick. Chef being really good with the press, tick.
did he ever come to Australia?
Yes, he did, because he had a restaurant here, that bore his name. Restaurant Paul Bocuse opened in 1991 at Daimaru, which is where Melbourne Central was, and it closed 7-8 years later. Now, Philippe Mouchel was the chef who came to Australia to set that up, and he had been the chef at the first Paul Bocuse restaurant in Japan. Now, there was a challenge because at the time when he went to Japan, it was about the first formal French restaurant to open in Japan. The Japanese had... you know the way we say, "What do you think this is?" That was the Japanese attitude to butter and cream. You know, "What do you think this is?"
Yeah, well, I mean, since then, the Japanese, I mean, their French pastries are absolutely incredible. They do them better than the French, I might even say.
Well,
they're
some
so beautiful.
Some
and they have beautiful French restaurants there now, cooked by, you know, incredible Japanese and French chefs.
Yep, that's right.
It's
so
amazing.
Huge extent. But the interesting thing for, and it's a great tribute to a chef, to Paul Bocuse, that he said, Philippe said, well, what am I going to do? There was also a Japanese chef in the restaurant who wasn't keen on this young French boy at muscling in on his territory. But Paul Bocuse was able to say to Philippe, you know what my food tastes like. You know what it tastes like. You know what it's meant to look like. You know what the ingredients should be. Modify the amount of butter you use, modify the amount of cream you use so that the food is more acceptable to Japanese palates. Now that, I mean, when I say he was a game changer, that was one of the ways in which he changed the game.
And Philippe Michel, he has a restaurant here in Melbourne. You want to tell us where that is?
It's called Philippe, and it's like every other Melbourne restaurant that's any good, it's hidden.
Oh, it's in a laneway, and it's actually not far from the Joy Studio, if I may recall.
That's right. It's in a laneway, and it's hidden. You go downstairs to Philippe rather than upstairs to lots of other places. It's off... Oh, golly,
it's
what's the laneway?
Collins.
It's off Collins.
And it runs between Collins and Flinders Lane.
That's right, the
and
laneway,
the
like
laneway
most of them.
The laneway is called... we'll have to come back to you on that one.
We'll come back to you on that one. But if you know where a place called Il Solito Posto is,
yes,
it's opposite that.
Now, Rita, at this point, I thought it might be interesting to introduce to the microphone Stefan, who is French, has been living in Australia now for 9 years and comes from a hospitality background. Stefan, tell me, are you familiar with the work of Paul Bocuse?
Not that much.
Not that much?
Sorry, I know Paul Bocuse from the press, and as you said, he was a very good media person, and I think when I was growing up, there was some produce in supermarket that he designed.
That's right. He copped a huge amount of flack for commercialising food,
and it was ready to eat in supermarkets. I was wondering what I got served. They deconstructed falafel a few weeks ago in a restaurant in Melbourne, and it was just a chickpea salad. What do you think Paul Bocuse would have?
You know how we were talking before about people saying, what's this? Do I eat this? I think that's pretty much what he would have said. Deconstructed falafel.
I was expecting something quite, I don't know what I was expecting, but it just came some chickpeas on the plate with a few tomatoes, which was quite... surprising.
Oh, there's someone who has got no idea. No idea at all. Golly, it's hard enough to construct falafel, probably. You wouldn't want to undo all your good work. This was someone who couldn't shape them properly.
Well, we are going to continue to talk about France. It's actually going to be the next part of the program because, of course, this is the Escape Hour.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
You are on the Escape Hour. It's been a really fun show today. We have a special guest, Rita Ehrlich, who's been on the program. And we have Stefan, who has just spoken on air for the first time. Well done, Stefan. Tess is in the studio talking food, and Dylan is talking food too. So it's been a big party in here.
Rita, and there's nothing to eat.
It's a lunchtime show with no lunch. But that's okay. We can all go out for lunch afterwards.
Yes, we could.
We could. Now, we were just talking a little bit about some French dishes, and you were discussing a dish that was going to be a part of an event this evening that you're participating in. I'm just trying to find out if there's any tickets left for this particular event.
This is the Paul Bocuse celebration dinner at Philippe Restaurant in the city, and he's doing a succession of dishes that really are all about not only Paul Bocuse's cooking, but French cooking. And so there's, and for me, there are a couple of dishes that are absolutely gorgeous because they're a really good example of how you get different styles of cooking. He does one dish. One of the dishes is œufs en mirette, which are eggs poached in red wine. They're usually served with mushrooms and little cubes of bacon. And I thought, right, give two chefs eggs, bacon, mushrooms, and you either get eggs poached in red wine.
Eggs poached in red wine. Oh, that's a new one for me.
Or you get breakfast. and the same thing he's doing, it's a fabulous dish, fish fillets. And on top of the fish fillets, there are very, very fine slices of potatoes arranged to look like fish scales.
And I looked at it and I thought,
okay, so this is really just fish and chips in another form. Because the scales are cooked, but they've got a nice crunch to them.
It sounds so incredibly delicious.
And sauces. Sauces are the things that really...
The French do so well.
Yeah.
Now, you travel to France quite reasonably frequently, and I know you were there last year. Is France one of your favourite travel destinations?
Yes, it is. It is. Why is it? For all sorts of reasons. Because there's enough going on, because I like the wine, I love the bread, I love the cheese, I love the seasons. I'm never there in winter and I'm never there in... I've only once been there in August, and all I can tell you is don't. August in most French places is pretty horrid because everyone's on holiday.
August throughout Europe can be
everyone from every other part of the world is also in France.
Now tell us about your recent trip. What did you discover, perhaps, that you had not discovered in your travels?
Well, this sounds terribly serious, but it was very, very important. What I discovered was that if you invest in regional towns, you need government investment in regional towns if they're going to be successful. If you pull out all the things that attract people to a regional town, that regional town will fail.
Yeah, it's certainly the same for regional towns in Australia as well.
Yeah, that's right. So I was in Maldon during the week and thinking, absolutely gorgeous. Now, the population of 3,500. And I'm thinking, right, you need two good restaurants in a town like this if people are going to stay over. There are heaps of other things to do. You know, there are bookshops, there are antique shops, there's lots and lots of walking, there are gorgeous places to stay, but you need a whole complex of things, and in lots of little French towns, there's a monument, there's a castle, there's a little regional museum, there's this or this that, and they all need some government support in order to become self-sufficient.
I would imagine that the French government probably has quite a good support network for not only the arts but for food and beverage, considering it's probably part of their national identity.
Yeah, that's right, part of their heritage. So that, there are lovely local markets. We stayed in a little town. It's got a local market that's open six mornings a week. There's a community bus that brings people to it who can't drive or who've never driven, and there is no one so old or so frail that they can't carry a shopping bag. No, and no plastic bags in the market. This is my little campaign too. No plastic bags at all in the market. A little cafe in the corner. And it's a town of 8,000 people.
And where was this town, Rita?
It's called Jarnac, and it's near a town called Cognac, which is much bigger, and Cognac's where they make the stuff called Cognac. And Jarnac's a companion town, so there are lots of Cognac houses in Jarnac. Mm. And I took a great shine to the stuff. Ooh, lovely.
One of the things I find about, I've only been to France a couple of times, but of course, naturally, I always end up in Paris. But, you know, I've seen enough French films in the countryside to know that I could spend my entire life rambling around the countryside. Yep. It is so beautiful.
It is just lovely. If you can drive It's useful, though there are really good local trains and buses, but you need to travel light if you're doing that. What else? Being able to say a few words of French is useful.
Yes.
Really useful. And knowing something of the local customs is useful. I was reading earlier about someone who went to Paul Bocuse's restaurant in France and loathed everything about it, starting with the fact that no waiter took her napkin off the table and placed it on her lap. Now, in France, that would be regarded as the height of bad manners, to kind of flap about in a stranger's lap. Nobody would do it.
So where did that custom come from that ended up in fine dining restaurants in Australia?
I don't know. It's very much an English thing, I think, or an American thing.
Okay.
And it's part of the, I'm your server tonight and I will look after you. But it's very interesting that different countries have very, very different rules.
But it's also quite fun.
It is. I mean, like, I've forgotten which country it is. So is it Germany or Poland, where to show you've finished your meal, you put your knife and fork at 180 degrees across the plate?
Wow. Well, that is confusing, isn't
it? Yeah, it's
it?
Very confusing. Where if you put them together, people think you're still eating.
Wow. Oh, my goodness. And then, of course, in countries like Japan, you can't put your chopsticks in your rice at a certain angle.
That's right.
That's
and you can't
very bad
stab.
Manners.
And you can't stab your food with chopsticks.
No, don't. No stabbing allowed.
Good general rule at the table. No stabbing allowed.
I want to ask Stéphane a little bit about where you're from in France, and tell us a little bit about your background.
So I've travelled a little bit. I was born in the south of France, in Marseille, which is on the Mediterranean Sea down there, and lived a few years there and lived in Normandy, in Rouen, which is the place where they use a lot of butter and a lot of cream. There's a lot of cheeses, and so good food all around.
Good food all around. And your family, you mentioned, was in the hospitality and the hotel industry.
Yes, my... I lived with an aunt and uncle who ran a restaurant and had a hotel restaurant in Rouen. So I was, from a young age, I was exposed to restaurants and hotel and hospitality, and worked in the bar for a few years and when I was studying, and then worked in pubs in England as well, which...
I reckon working in the hospitality industry is really good training for getting on with strangers.
It certainly is, yes.
Yes, it is. Getting patience, developing patience. And yeah. Yes.
Do you, Stéphane, do you work in the hospitality industry in Melbourne now you're here?
No, I'm a nurse. And
right, you're a nurse and now you're on Joy.
Yes, so it's all a bit... But it gave me, I think, some skills to be interacting with people.
And if you, no doubt you would have people who would say to you, I'm on my way to France, what shall I do when I get there? Do you have any, you know, tips or places that you like to tell people to visit that perhaps that might not be in the guidebooks?
It is a big country. It's a little
it
bit...
It is a big country,
I would say just go to the markets and do all this kind of thing that local people do. There's a lot of little shops as well, rather than going to supermarkets, shop local, support this bakery.
You're right, and every market has little restaurants around it.
Oh, yes, I do recall that.
And the best way to learn French is to go to the market and look at the names of the fish, so that when you see them on a menu, you know what they are.
That's very good advice. Absolutely. Tell me, do you visit very often, Stéphane?
I try to go once a year or 18 months or so. So I went there in winter. I went in back in December and spent all of December in mostly in Normandy in south of France.
Did you freeze or hadn't the snow begun?
We got there when it was snowing, and then it got really cool, unusual for the season. So,
So you were there over the holiday period. Do you have any food traditions in your family that you celebrate over holidays?
Oh, the traditional European Christmas, I guess, which is on Christmas Eve in France, with too much food, and loads of cheese, which is probably something I miss living here. This
Absolutely.
Yeah, I would say, yeah.
Oh, well, you can get back into the spirit of things. We love to eat a lot here in this town. For sure. So I would love to know more, Rita, about what your other favourite things to do when you're in France. I mean, obviously you spend some time in Paris. Do you prefer to go to museums, or do you like to spend every waking moment in a restaurant?
Not every waking. I love museums. I love walking. Walking's the thing I most like doing. Mm. And then you see you stop for lunch, mm-hmm. and you stop to go to a museum, and you stop for a drink in the afternoon. And you might stop for a pastry if there's a good patisserie around. And then there's dinner. what's not to like? And there are, particularly in Paris, there are always fabulous exhibitions in the galleries.
There is, absolutely. I saw some fantastic art when I was there a couple of years ago. And we were going to talk in this last few minutes, we were going to have a quick chat about cookbooks, because you mentioned a cookbook that is one of your favourites.
That's the one I did with Philippe Mouchel called More Than French, because he'd spent so much time in Japan and in Australia. The other one I adore, like everyone else, Otto Lengi's cookbooks
are my fantastic
favourite, particularly the Jerusalem one.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And another long-term favourite is Marcella Hazan, who's out of favour a bit, but her Essentials of Italian Cooking is brilliant.
Have you ever written a cookbook for yourself of your own cooking? Rita?
I'm under great pressure from two sons to do that.
Uh-huh. You heard it here first.
can we have written down all the things that we like to eat and that you have made over the years, and it's not good enough to say, you know how I do it. You have to write it down.
The Ehrlich Family Cookbook.
Yeah.
Stay tuned, everyone. It'll be in your bookshops very soon. Well, we need to wrap it up. Rita, I really appreciate you coming on to tell us all about it. You'll be speaking again at the Business of Food Expo, which is on March 5th. That is through the City of Kingston, if anyone wants more information. Thank you, Stefan, your virgin trip on radio. Thanks, Dylan, for panelling.
Thank you.
And thanks, Tess, for coming in and getting into the food chat.
Pleasure. I loved listening.
Next week, I won't be here. Russ will be here, and we are going to Mexico. Woohoo!
Yum.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.